Today is the 17th of October, and I forgot to turn on my recorder during class, so I'm sitting here in the basement, and I'm going to try to reconstruct as best I can what transpired this morning. It was really a really good class, and I'm sorry I didn't remember to turn on the recording because there were a lot of good comments that were made, and I'm going to try to remember not only what I did, but what various people remarked during the class. I did start off by talking about a question that Reuben had asked, I guess last week, about, you know, Iblis, who is the great tempter, remember, that in the Adam stories that we have read up to now. He is the one who refuses to bow down to Adam when Adam's talking to the angels and says, bow down to Adam, and Iblis says, well, I'm made of fire, and he's just made of clay. You know, I'm not gonna bow down to an inferior being. And then God, well, threatens to send Iblis directly to hell, and then he begs for a stay of execution, as it were. And so God says, okay, you know, we'll wait till judgment day. And then Iblis then says, aha, now I'm gonna tempt human beings to do wrong. I'm going to spend my time doing that. And next thing you know, it says Satan tempted Adam and Eve to eat of the forbidden fruit, etc., etc. And so the question was, well, it said that Iblis is a, made of fire, as I pointed out. And so the question was, are angels, or is it, are some angels at least, made of fire? And so I did a little bit of research online on that, and the answer is no. Angels are made of light, but jinn are made of fire. And so the question then is, well, how did he wind up in heaven? Did he wander up there, just get lost or something? Was he kidnapped by the angels? I don't know. But it starts off talking about the angels. Next thing you know, Iblis is there and, you know, refuses to bow down, unlike all the angels. So I don't know the answer to that. But anyway, I think I did answer Reuben's question. Let me see now. And then before we got started, Reuben asked another question about the Quran and wanted me to clarify in what sense it pre-existed. And basically was, and I guess sort of was said, well, is it a matter of just, it's kind of coming into being as it's getting revealed? I mean, remember, there's a copy in heaven. So the question is, well, was it kind of getting written as it was getting revealed, or was it already there? And clearly the answer is the latter, and even more so, because there are lots of references in the Quran to the book. And the question is, well, what is the book? Is it the Quran? It appears to be something broader than that, because it seems to be in other places as well, talking about somebody's life being or termination, I think, somewhere I read, you know, being written in the book. So it would seem to be, I didn't mention this in class, but it's what's called the preserved tablet. And the Quran would seem to be a part of it. So, but anyway, that's the answer to Reuben's question, is that it exists eternally in heaven, and is not a matter of just being written or created in the way that it is piece by piece during the life of Muhammad as it was getting revealed to him. But what was getting revealed was already there in toto, and in more than toto. At that point, I began reading some of the other, finishing up the stories of Adam. And let me just find the one where I left off at 70. So I'm on 18 now, 1851. That's the one I started off with, I think. So here's the next one. There aren't too many left. Remember the time when we said to the angels, submit to Adam, and they all submitted except Iblis. Now, this is interesting, though. It explicitly says here, he was one of the jinn. and he disobeyed the command of his Lord, which dovetails exactly with what we read earlier when Iblis says, I'm a fire creature, and Adam was made of clay. That's why I don't need to submit. So anyway, explicitly here, he was one of the jinn, and he disobeyed the command of his Lord. Will you then take him and his offspring for friends instead of me while they are your enemies? Evil is the exchange for the wrongdoers. So that's, provides a little more information than it explicitly confirms that Iblis is one of the jinn. Okay, the next one, 20:116-125. Okay. And verily, we had made a covenant with Adam beforehand, but he forgot, and we found in him no determination to disobey. So, he just forgot. And when we said to the angels, submit to Adam, and they all submitted, but Iblis did not, he refused. Then we said, O Adam, this is an enemy to thee and to thy wife, so let him not drive you both out of the garden, lest thou come to grief. It is provided for thee that thou wilt not hunger therein, nor wilt thou be naked, and thou wilt not thirst therein, nor wilt thou be exposed to the sun. But Satan whispered evil suggestions to him. He said, O Adam, shall I lead thee to the tree of eternity and to a kingdom that never decays? Then they both ate thereof, so that their shame became manifest to them, and they began to stick the leaves of the garden together over themselves. And Adam observed not the commandment of his Lord, so that his life became miserable. Then his Lord chose him for his grace and turned to him with mercy and guided him. He said, Go forth, both of you, from here, some of you being enemies of others, and if there comes to you guidance from me, then whoso will follow my guidance, he will not go astray, nor will he come to grief. But whosoever will turn away from my reminder, his will be a straight life, and on the day of resurrection, we shall raise him up blind. Okay. But whosoever will turn away from my reminder, his will be a straight life, and on the day of resurrection, we shall raise him up blind. This is interesting, too. We have some further information, right? We have the information at the beginning that he forgot. It was not malicious. His disobedience was not malicious. And that's why he was really forgiven, right? He observed not the commandment, and so his life became miserable. But then God forgave him, or at least turned to him with mercy. And then this, I said at the class, it sounds to me like Adam's commission. Adam, of course, is the first prophet, and this sounds to me like God's sort of giving him a commission now to go and prophesy, because I'll reread that little part. And if there be, and if there comes to you guidance, you being Adam, guidance from me, then whoso will follow my guidance, he will not go astray, nor will he come to grief. And then he calls him his reminder, right? But whosoever will turn away from my reminder, his will be a straight life, and on the day of resurrection we should raise him up blind. So Adam is a reminder. He's there to remind people, I guess his grandchildren and great-grandchildren or whatever. But anyway, he's there to remind people what God expects of them. So the other interesting thing, the two interesting things about this, I guess, are first of all that his disobedience was a venial sin, or in the Middle Ages you'd say it's a venial sin, not a mortal sin. And then God now forgives him or grants him mercy and basically commissions him to be his first prophet. Okay. Okay, the next one, where am I? 20. So, yes, 38. There's So this is 38, 72 to 86. When thy Lord said to the angels, I am about to create man from clay, and so when I have fashioned him in perfection and have breathed in him, into him my spirit, fall ye down in submission to him. So the angels submitted all of them together, but Iblis did not. He behaved proudly and was one of those who disbelieved. God said, O Iblis, what hindered thee from submitting to what I had created with my two hands? Is it that thou art too proud, or art thou really one of the exalted ones? He said, I am better than he. Thou hast created me of fire, and him thou hast created of clay. God said, Then get out hence, for surely thou art rejected, and surely on thee shall be my curse till the day of judgment. And he said, this would be Iblis replying, My Lord, then grant me respite till the day when they shall be raised. God said, Certainly thou art of those who are, that are granted respite, till the day of the appointed time. He said, Iblis said, So, by thy might I will surely lead them astray, except thy chosen servants from among them. God said, Then the truth is, and the truth I speak. That I will certainly fill hell with thee and with those who follow thee altogether. So this is, I don't think there's anything new in this one. God commands all the angels to fall down and obey Adam, and they do, and Iblis doesn't. And the same deal, he is made of fire and Adam is made of clay. And God then says, you're cursed. And then he asks for a reprieve. And God said, okay, till the day of judgment. And then he said, okay, now I'm going to spend my time tempting humankind. And then God says, yeah, and the ones that, except for thy chosen servants. That's interesting. I mean, we will at some point talk about predestination, but not right now. And then God says, well, you know, those then who go and follow you, they will... I will fill hell with you and all the people who follow you. So that's all very familiar. Now there's one more sort of Adam story. And that one is Surah 5, 28 through 32. You'll see what I mean when I say sort of. And relate to them truly the story of the two sons of Adam. When they each offer... Oh, before I read this, though. Wait a minute. Before I read this, I want to mention Marty's comment. She had commented earlier that one of the interesting differences between the Quran account of the fall and the biblical account of the fall is that Adam and Eve together eat of the forbidden fruit. I mean, in the biblical account, Eve is kind of the responsible party. I mean, she's the one who gets... persuaded by the serpent, and then she persuades her husband. So this is kind of your typical, well, like, you know, the males would be virtuous if it wasn't for these weak females who sort of wind up being intermediaries in their corruption. But in the Quran account, there is no intermediation by Eve. I mean, they're both just equally guilty, you know. She made that observation last week, I think. But today, she mentioned, also interestingly, except maybe for that little phrase, when Adam disobeyed God, he was made miserable, but that's pretty generic. But Marty then said, you know, the other thing that's missing is this idea that, Adam has to now till the soil by the sweat of his brow, and Eve will suffer the pain of childbirth. I mean, these are part of the punishment that's imposed on them for their disobedience. And none of that in the Quran. I replied that, you know what that is in the Bible, it's a just so story. And I get the phrase from Kipling, and I recounted the one I remember is, you know, why do elephants have a trunk? You know, back in the day, they used to have noses, and then one day an elephant was drinking from the river, and a crocodile grabbed him by the nose, and the elephant backed up and stretched and stretched and stretched, and ever since they've had trunks. So, I mean, a just-so story then is, well, sort of the prototypical member of the species, this is what happened to that prototypical member. And as a result, ever since, all other members of the species have had that same characteristic. So, you know, why is it that we toil and sweat so much, you know, raising crops from the recalcitrant earth? And why is our life so hard, just so much physical labor involved in just feeding ourselves? That's from the male perspective. And then for the female, from the female perspective, why is childbirth so painful? Other animals don't seem to be pained nearly so much in giving birth, but humans, it's just horribly painful. Why? And, well, answer. Well, because the first humans, you know, they disobeyed God, and they would have had an easy time of it in paradise, but they screwed up, and now you earn your bread by the sweat of your brow, and you, you know, labor to bring new life into the earth. So these are just-so stories. But the just-so stories are missing here in the Quran. So that's interesting, too. You know, it is interesting, just the variations of well-known stories. But anyway, this next one coming up is obviously Cain and Abel. That, so I put it under Adam because they are the sons of Adam, it says. And relate to them truly the story of the two sons of Adam, when they each offered an offering, and it was accepted from one of them and was not accepted from the other. The latter said, I will surely kill thee. The former replied, Allah accepts only from the righteous. If thou stretch out thy hand against me to kill me, I am not going to stretch out my hand against thee to kill thee. I do fear Allah, the Lord of the universe. I wish that thou shouldst bear my sin as well as thy sin, and thus be among the inmates of the fire, and that is the reward of those who do wrong. But his mind, so that's what Abel says to Cain, but his mind induced him to kill his brother, and so he killed him and became one of the losers. Then Allah sent a raven, which scratched in the ground, that he might show him how to hide the corpse of his brother. He said, woe is me, am I not able to be even like this raven, so that I may hide the corpse of my brother? And then he became regretful. Well, that's weird. So, first of all, there are a lot of differences right here. I mean, first of all, Cain announces to Abel that he's going to kill him, which in the Bible, that's certainly not the case. In the Bible, he just does. And then there's this long reply of Abel to Cain, that, well, you know, if you try to kill me, I'm not going to try to kill you. My trust is in Allah, blah, blah, blah. And by the way, if you do that, then you're going to be one of the inmates of the fire, because that's the reward of those who do wrong. So all that whole little soliloquy there is certainly not in the biblical account. And then Cain kills Abel. But then the raven business, that's, you know. So I guess this is another just so story. Why do we bury our dead? Well, once upon a time, you know, Cain killed Abel and had no idea what to do, you know. And then a raven came along and scratched in the ground and gave him the idea, ah, what we need to do is bury our dead. And so that's what he did. I guess that's the significance of it. I guess it's just another just so story. Interesting. So that's the end of the Adam stories. Now, the next prophet is Idris. That is Aleph, I-D-R, long I-S. And Idris is Enoch. Now, Enoch is unique among the early patriarchs because other than being begotten and begetting, there's nothing we know about these early patriarchs except for Enoch. We do know that he followed God's ways to an unusual extent, I guess, and therefore at the end was translated directly into heaven, kind of like Elijah on a fiery chariot or Jesus ascending into heaven or something like that. There aren't many biblical worthies who were translated directly into heaven, but Enoch was one of them, really the first. And so he turns out to be then the second prophet, but there's just as little information about Idris or Enoch in the Quran as there is about Enoch in the Bible. And so there's just two little passages. One is Surah 19:57-58, and it goes like this: "And relate the story of Idris, as mentioned in the book. He was a truthful man and a prophet, and we exalted him to a lofty station." All right, well, that's kind of like the Old Testament story, right? You know, reminds me of it. And then the next one's 21:86-87. So these are just little snippets here. Wait a minute, 21:86-87. Oh. "And remember Ishmael and Idris and Dal Kifl. All were of the steadfast, and we admitted them to our mercy. Surely they were of the righteous." So, not very really all that informative. And that's all we know about Idris. So, as I said, you know, the Quran doesn't give us any, assuming the equivalents, the Quran doesn't give us any more information about him than the Bible does about Enoch. So there we are with that one. I was just looking this up. You know, I don't think it's spelled correctly here. Zulkifli. Dalkifli. Oh, that's somebody else. Dalkifli. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's another name. That's Ezekiel, by the way. But we'll get to Ezekiel down the road. All right, so then now we move to prophet number three. And prophet number three is Nuh. Now that's N, long U, and the H with a dot under it. So it's the H that, you know, comes more from the back of the throat. And that's Noah, of course. Now I'm going to skip all the passages that just mention him in passing. A lot of the time, there will be a passage, something like, "And remember X and Y and Z who were, you know, my messengers," or something like that. They don't give any details. They just mention the names. And I'm not going to, except for the ones like, you know, Idris, who there's nothing else about him. I'm not going to go over those passages. So there are two stories about Noah. And I was actually going to read, I was going to start with the flood, but actually I decided to read the second one first. There's only one passage on the other story, the second story, and that's a story about Noah's wife. And it's interesting. And here it is. This is Surah 66, verse 11. "Allah sets forth for those who disbelieve the example of the wife of Noah and the wife of Lot. They were under two righteous servants of ours, but they acted unfaithfully towards them. So they availed them naught against Allah, and it was said to them, 'Enter the fire, ye twain, along with those who enter.'" So, now, my recollection is, other than being mentioned in the Bible, you know, as one of the ones who boarded the ark and thus was saved from the flood, Mrs. Noah, we don't know a thing about her. We don't know her name even. And certainly don't know anything about her character or personality or anything like that. We do know a little bit more about Lot's wife, remember, because when they flee the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, God instructs them not to look back, remember? And she looks back and gets turned into a pillar of salt. So she did something bad. She disobeyed God. Now, I don't know that it was as serious as sounds like it is here. I mean, you know, enter the fire along with all the others that Iterola says to them. They acted unfaithfully. Well, so I'm not sure. But anyway, apparently Noah's wife is just as guilty as Lot's wife, or more so even than this portrayed in the Bible. Now, exactly what that was, well, more on that in a minute, thanks to Bonnie. But I was when I read that, I kind of chuckled about it because I was reminded of the Benjamin Britten play or musical, I guess you'd call it, Noah's Flood, which is based on, I think, a medieval libretto, a medieval text, and he just wrote the music for it. But there, interestingly, Noah's wife has a pretty decided personality. She's a real shrew. I mean, she's a terror. You don't want to, you know, get on her wrong side at all. And I guess that represents set of stories that were passed around in Western Europe during the Middle Ages, you know, and where Noah's wife actually had a personality, and it was not a good one. Well, this is something different, I imagine. I mean, being a shrew is not necessarily going to get you thrown into hell. So, but it did remind me of that. So that just means that there are other stories circulating about these people that flesh out some of the kernels that are to be found in the Bible. You know, stuff grew around those kernels, and one of them had to do with the character of Noah's wife. But it's interesting that in both cases it's negative. You know, she was something about her. I don't know why. Got a bad rep, and so that was true in the Arabian Peninsula too, even if it was a different bad rep, but still a bad rep. So let me read. Oh my, now where did I get to? Oh my goodness. I think I know. I think I remember. So I'm going to start with the flood story. So that is 7:60-65. We sent Noah to his people, and he said, O my people, worship Allah. You have no other God but him. Indeed, I fear for you the punishment of the great day. The chiefs of his people said, Surely we see thee to be in manifest error. He said, O my people, there is no error in me, but I am a messenger from the Lord of the worlds. I deliver to you the messages of my Lord and give you sincere advice, and I know from Allah what you do not know. Do you wonder that an exhortation has come to you from your Lord through a man from among yourselves, that he may warn you, and that you may become righteous, and that you may be shown mercy? But they accused him of falsehood, so that we, that is God, saved him and those with him in the ark. And we drowned those who rejected our signs. They were indeed a blind people. That's the royal we, as I was asked by Reuben. A lot of this is, you know, remember, this is God talking through Gabriel to Muhammad. So a lot of the time it's in the first person. Not always, though, but a lot of the time it is. Well, anyway, so we have here the familiar Noah story, right? I mean, he's saying, this is the typical monotheistic plea that we find over and over and over again in the Quran. You know, worship Allah, you have no other God but him. And then they say, not true. And then he says, I'm a messenger from the Lord of the worlds, and I'm just giving you advice. I know I have insight that you don't have. And won't you accept what I say and you'll be shown mercy? And they accuse him of falsehood. And of course, then we drowned them all. So that's close, but a lot of details are left out. close to the biblical story. All right, 10:72-74 is next. Okay. And recite unto them the story of Noah, when he said to his people, O my people, if my station with God and my reminding you of your duty through the signs of Allah offend you, and in Allah do I put my trust, muster then all your designs, you and your partners. Then let not your course of action be obscure to you. Then carry out your designs against me and give me no respite. But if you turn your back, remember, I have not asked of you any reward. My reward is with Allah alone, and I have been commanded to be of those who are resigned to him. But they rejected him. So we saved him and those who were with him in the ark, and we made them inheritors of our favors, while we drowned those who rejected our signs. See then how was the end of those who had been warned. So, same kind of thing. He says, you know, Allah, I put my trust in Allah. I'm a warner here. Don't turn your back, but of course they do, and they get drowned. Okay. The next one is really long, 11:26-49, but very rich in information. In fact, it's, well, 11's a very long surah anyway. This is a hefty part of it. Okay, here it is. And we sent Noah to his people, and he said, truly, I am a plain warner to you, that you worship none but Allah. Indeed, I fear for you the punishment of a grievous day. The chiefs of his people, who disbelieved, replied, we see in thee nothing but a man like ourselves. And we see that none have followed thee but those who, to all our outward appearance, are the meanest of us. And we do not see in you any superiority over us. Nay, we believe you to be liars. So, you know, what they're expecting then is, well, if this is really from the divine, we expect to see somebody who is extraordinary. And, he's just an ordinary guy, right? And as a matter of fact, the people who have been following him, we don't even think very much of. They've been sort of the dregs of society. He said, oh, my people, tell me, if I stand on a clear proof from my Lord, and he has bestowed upon me from himself a great mercy which has been rendered obscure to you, shall we force it upon you while you are averse thereto? And, O my people, I ask not of you any wealth in return for it. My reward is due from Allah alone. And I am not going to drive away those who believe. They shall certainly meet their Lord. But I consider you to be a people who act ignorantly. And, O my people, who would help me against Allah if I were to drive them away? Will you not then consider? And I say not to you, I possess the treasures of Allah, nor do I know the unseen, nor say I am an angel. In other words, I'm just an ordinary person. Nor say I concerning those whom your eyes despise, Allah will not bestow any good upon them. Allah knows best whatever is in their minds. Surely I then should be of the unjust. So far, he's simply agreeing that I'm just an ordinary person. I'm not, you know, I'm not a extraordinarily, you know, I guess he's extraordinarily upright, but I don't have kind of authority. I'm not an angel. He explicitly says that. I'm not an angel, because that was their complaint, you know, that, but you're just a plain person, you know. Why should we accept what you say? As though they wouldn't believe anybody except for an angel. It reminds me of a lot of that. Now, we'll eventually, of course, get to Muhammad, who's prophet number 25. And it reminds me of a lot of passages in those sections where Muhammad is defending himself against people who obviously thought he was crazy. I mean, you know, here's a guy. And he comes out and says, you know, comes back to town and says, you know, guess what? I was standing in a cave or sitting in a cave, and the angel Gabriel appeared to me, and this is what the angel Gabriel said. You know, how would you react if somebody said that? You know, I think you maybe need to see a doctor or something like that. You know, you're having these visions. And, so, I mean, there are a lot of passages in the Quran where Muhammad is talking about himself, where he's reminding people, I'm just as sane as the next person. I'm not nutty. This really happened. Well, the necessity for that defense apparently goes all the way back to Noah, because that's kind of what they're saying too. Anyway, they said, "O Noah, thou hast indeed disputed with us long and hast disputed with us many a time. Bring us now that with which thou threatenest us, if there are of those who speak the truth." He said, "Allah alone will bring it to you, if he please, and you cannot frustrate God's purpose. And my advice will profit you not if I desire to advise you. If Allah intends to destroy you, he is your Lord, and to him shall you be made to return." Do they say, "He has forged it"? Say, "If I have forged it, on me be my sin, and I am clear of the sins you commit." Now that's out of the clear blue, isn't it? The way this is punctuated, by the way, the end of Noah's reply is not that verse, but the previous verse, "He is your Lord, and to him shall you be made to return." And then I turned the page, and it almost makes me wonder if I'd turned two pages, but nope, it's the next page. Do they say, quote, "He has forged it"? Say, and if they do, say, "If I have forged it, on me be my sin, and I am clear of the sins you commit." I guess that's not a comment about Muhammad, but I guess it's another accusation by, I mean, in this context, I guess it's another accusation by the people of Noah saying, "He's just made all this stuff up. You know, he has forged it. He's just making this. He's just making stuff up." And then he says, "Well, okay, if that's the case, then on my head be the curse." Anyway, and it was revealed to Noah. But anyway, that's a lot like those things about Muhammad. You know, also the accusing Muhammad of having hallucinations and not taking him seriously. And it was revealed to Noah, "None of thy people will believe except those who have already believed. Grieve not, therefore, at what they have been doing. And build thou the ark under our eyes, and as commanded by our revelation. And address not me concerning the wrongdoers. They are surely going to be drowned." So, you know, forget it. Don't plead their case. I've already made up my mind. "And as he was making the ark," and every time the chiefs, and I'm sorry, "and he was making the ark. And every time the chiefs of his people passed by him, they mocked at him. He said, 'If now you mock us, the time is coming when we shall mock at you, even just as you mock now. Then you shall know who it is on whom will come a punishment that will disgrace him, and on whom will fall a lasting punishment. Till when our command came and the fountains..." So that's the end of Noah's reply. "Till when our command came and the fountains of the earth gushed forth, we said, 'Embark therein two of every kind, male and female, and thy family, except those against whom the word has already gone forth, and those who believe.' And there did not believe and live with him except a few." Now that's interesting. Because, I mean, of course, you got your two, your male and female of all, every kind. And you got Noah and his family, except those against whom the word has already gone forth. So, anybody in his family who is doomed will not board the ark. And that's interesting, because in the Bible, of course, Noah's three sons, and this is all he mentions, all the Bible mentions, you know, board the ark along with everybody else in the same family. And then, not only that, but, "and those who believe." So, I mean, remember, it already said that Noah had managed to at least convince a few people that he was telling the truth, well, those people, of course, get to be saved too. So the inhabitants of the ark are a little bit different here than they are in the Bible. Not many, though, says just a few. And he said, this is, this is Noah talking. I'm trying to figure who was talking. And he said, embark therein. The name of Allah be its course and its mooring. My Lord is assuredly most forgiving and merciful. Well, I remarked at the time, that's a very common epithet of God, of course, merciful. But no, really merciful for those who believe and obey Allah. So the mercy is very much confined to the people who pass the test. The other people, not at all merciful, just the reverse. God is primarily just in the Quran. You know, God sends prophets, God sends warners who go out and they say, look, there's only one God, and that's Allah. You need to recognize that, and you need to submit to Allah. That's what Islam even means. You need to submit to Allah. You need to believe. You need to do good works, what Allah tells you to do. You need to repent. And if you do all those things, then you'll be saved. And you will enjoy pleasures beyond your wildest imagination. But if you refuse to do those things, you will be punished so severely that you will wish every instant of from now until eternity that you had never been born. I mean, it's horrible, horrible. I mean, extremes on both ends. Well, that's not mercy, right? The other half of it is not mercy at all. But the whole business is justice. You know, God is saying, look, here's what you're going to be tested on. I'm giving you the answers to the test. You know, that's all you need to do is just remember these answers. And when the day of the test comes, then you either pass or you fail. Here are the answers. Well, guess what? Most people don't bother and they fail. So anyway, even though merciful is a very common epithet of Allah in the Quran, I would say God is merciful to those who are saved and those who are worth saving, but not to those who are damned. And primarily, God is just. Okay, anyway, and it, the ark, moved along with them on waves like mountains. And Noah cried unto his son while he was keeping apart, O my son, embark with us, and be not with the disbelievers. He replied, I shall soon betake myself to a mountain which will shelter me from the water. That's the son replying. Then Noah, he said, there is no shelter for anyone this day from the decree of Allah, excepting those to whom he shows mercy. And the wave came in between the two, so he was among the drowned. So, here we go. Remember, and I don't think I've made this as clear in class as it is to me now, back when he... God is telling him, you know, take two of every kind and so forth. And it says, you know, and thy family except those against whom the word has already gone forth. So I guess that except is governed by the word family. So in other words, everybody in your family except for this son of yours who is a disbeliever. I mean, that's what must be referred to there. And then, of course, then it says, and those who believe. That's other people that other than the family members. So there's this wayward son that Noah, who still loves his son, you know, says, you know, come into the ark. And the son, not being a, well, I guess being one of the ones that are destined to be drowned, says, oh, don't worry, I'll climb up to the top of a mountain. That'd be okay. And Noah says, that's not going to work. And sure enough, it didn't. Yeah, I'm going to read a little more and then, I will. Because, yeah, okay, let me go on. And it was said, O earth, swallow thy water, and O sky, cease raining. That would be God talking. And the water was made to subside, and the matter was ended. And the ark came to rest on Al-Judi. And it was said, "Cursed be the wrong-headed people." And Noah cried unto his Lord and said, "My Lord, verily my son is of my family, and surely thy promise is true, and thou art the most just of judges." He said, that's God speaking, "O Noah, he is surely not of thy family. He is indeed a man of unrighteous conduct. So ask not of me that of which thou hast no knowledge. I advise thee lest thou become one of the ignorant." He said, that's Noah, "My Lord, I beg thee to protect me from asking thee that whereof I have no knowledge. And unless thou forgive me and have mercy on me, I shall be among the losers." It was said, "O Noah, descend then with peace from us and blessings upon thee and upon peoples to be born of those with thee. And there will be other peoples whom we shall grant provision for a time. Then shall a grievous punishment touch them from us." Okay. So, let's see here. Yeah, that's right. So, half of the story is taken up with this story of the son who was wayward and not one of the saved. And, of course, that's not in the Bible at all. And then Bonnie suggested that Bonnie then went back to that one comment that God makes right here. Well, in response to Noah saying, "Verily, my son is of my family, and surely your promise is true," and so forth. And then God says, "Oh, Noah, he is surely not of thy family, and he's a man of unrighteous conduct. Don't ask me to, you know, have mercy on him." Well, of course, when I read that, when he says he is surely not of thy family, the way I took it was, well, he's not, he's a disbeliever. He's not worthy to be your son. Not that he's not his biological son, but he's just not worthy to be your son. And it didn't occur to me to take it literally. But Bonnie took it literally, or at least considered the possibility it was literally true. And if that's the case, and it very well may be, and if that's the case, she said, well, maybe that explains why Mrs. Noah was so considered to be so awful. You know, maybe there's some hanky-panky going on out there, and this is not really his son. Huh! I thought that was pretty brilliant, kind of like a detective connecting the dots. And then I started talking about, well, you know what that reminds me of, interestingly. I forget if I've talked about it in here or not. But it reminds me of the Islamic theologians, the Mutakallimun, because the early theologians, the earliest of the Muslim, the earliest Muslim theological school, put it that way, were the Mu'tazilites. And the Mu'tazilites were the liberals, the theological liberals. The whole deal reminds me of Christianity because, you know, before the church councils, Christian doctrine was very much more in flux. And Origen, for example, is a very, you know, bold speculative thinker and is actually freer to speculate about a lot of things than somebody would have been 100 years later. As a matter of fact, I then went on to point out that the early translation, by early, I mean it was around the turn of the 20th century of the patristic writings, that multi-volume thing. Philip Schaff, I believe, is the overall editor, or was. And anyway, those are divided into two groups. The first is the anti-Nicene group, the A-N-T-E, not A-N-T-I, but A-N-T-E, the pre-Nicene group of thinkers. And then the other is the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers of the church. So, you know, and there's a reason for that division, because the church councils started, I guess, clarifying what Christianity is really supposed to be about, and thus limiting the options for subsequent thinkers. There are certain things that are just going to be out of bounds, and they became clearer at the councils. So anyway, the same thing seems to be going on in Islam. The earliest of the theologians seem to be more freer to speculate. And the Mu'tazilites were great allegorists, and they were all the time allegorizing Scripture. And you can see why. I mean, when the Bible, for example, says something, and it just seems crazy, one's natural inclination is to think, well, if it's supposed to be true, then it must mean something else. You know, it talks about God's hands, God's face, God's back, you know, that sort of thing. Well, we don't take that literally. We take that allegorically. Maybe God's arm is God's might or something like that. I don't know. And God's face is God's essence. God's back is God's energies, as Gregory of Nyssa would put it. Stuff like that. And the Mu'tazilites were very much along those lines. So if something just didn't make much sense, they'd say, oh, it doesn't really mean that. It really means this other thing. The Asherites, though, were the reaction, the conservative reaction against this. And actually, the Asherite school became the dominant theological school in the Middle Ages. Al-Ashari was the founder of the Asherite school of theology. And they were much, much more literal. They were much more inclined to take things literally. If it says God has a throne, guess what? God has a throne. If it says there's a book, guess what? There's a book. And book means book. You know, it doesn't mean something that, you know, it doesn't mean a book in heaven. It doesn't mean something that came into being gradually with Muhammad. It means something that eternally existed in heaven. All this stuff, I mean, it's all... a lot of the doctrines of the Asherites, the physical rewards and punishments in the afterlife. I mean, the Quran says, you know, fire for the damned. Well, guess what? Fire means fire. It doesn't mean psychological torment. It doesn't mean the fire of regret or something like that. No, the fire means fire, period. Well, anyway, so Bonnie's comment reminded me of that, because when I read it, of course, my first reaction was, well, all that means is he's not worthy to be your son because he's one of the disbelievers, and that's why he's getting drowned with all the others. But Bonnie then, you know, was kind of thinking about, well, you know, maybe he really wasn't Noah's son. And what does that say about Mrs. Noah? So I thought that was really interesting. Anyway. Then, that was such a long one. I didn't have time for much else. I just had time for one more. And that one is 21:77 through 78. Wait a minute. Oh, right. Where am I? Oh, here. I got to go here. Yeah. Yeah. And this is, yeah, this is not much. And remember Noah, when he cried unto us aforetime, and we heard his prayer and delivered him and his family from the great distress. And we helped him against the people who rejected our signs. They were surely a wicked people, and so we drowned them all. So anyway, that's nothing new there. And I think that's as far as we got. So anyway, next week we'll pick up with Noah again. We got another dozen or so references to various, well, to the flood story. As I look through my notes here, you know, Noah is one of the big ones. And oddly enough, remember the next two coming up are Hud and Salih. And those are really minor figures in the Bible. But they play a major role, too, in the Quran, Eber and Shelah. And then, of course, Abraham, a lot on that. It's a lot on Lot, a lot on Moses, a lot on Jethro, even. Well, anyway, that's what's coming up. And as you can see now, of course, as I said at the very beginning, there are a lot of, these are obviously recognizable stories. But there are a lot of details in the Bible that are not in the Quran, and there are a lot of details in the Quran that are not in the Bible. So it's interesting, isn't it? Just says something about the kind of thing floating, kind of things that were floating around. All righty. Next week, I hope I will remember to turn this thing on. Bye.